Thank you very much. I would like to call to order the Senate Committee on Human Services. Today is April 5th. We will be doing public hearings first, and we will start with Senate Bill 841. So with that, would you like to just tell us what that is, Matt?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 841 clarifies that state agencies and departments shall purchase certain products and services from the Commission for the Blind. It establishes a business enterprise program within the Commission to maintain and manage authorized vending facilities. It requires the Commission to facilitate certain dispute resolution meetings. It also requires the Commission to submit an annual report to the Legislative Assembly. It becomes operative January 1st, 2018, and the measure declares emergency and is effective on passage.
Thank you very much. In the first panel, we have four signed up, so we'll do two at a time. We'll do Randy, is it Houth?
Yes.
And Art Stevenson, please. And remember, when you testify, please start by stating your name so that we know who you are. Randy, would you like to start?
I sure would. Good afternoon, Chair Olson and committee members. My name is Randy Houth. I am a lifelong blind Oregon resident. I suffer from optic atrophy, heredity. Got it from my grandma. So anyway, I serve on the Randall Shepherd Vendors of America Board as a national advocacy board for the Randall Shepherd Vending Program. I also serve as the elected chair for the Business Enterprise Consumer Committee here in Oregon, which is a public body mandated to represent the licensed blind vendors of Oregon. And that is why I'm here today. I do want to share with the committee, I am here in support of Senate Bill 841 and the amendments that are forthcoming. But we are here today at the public hearing, and so wanted to share with the committee a few observations that I've made over the years. I've been a licensed blind vendor for 30 years, and I've traveled the United States trying to pick some of the successful concepts and ideas and legal language from other states that have this program dialed in and they're clicking, and tried to bring those back here to Oregon to make sure that we can have a successful, vibrant, and robust program. Currently in Oregon, the stumbling blocks are that there's not currently a robust recruitment and training program for people who are blind. We have 14 blind vendors. The state licensing agency, the Oregon Commission for the Blind, who is responsible to promote this program, we have not had a blind manager into our program for over 10 years. So it not only encourages program growth, but it also strengthens the language of the law. It strengthens the preference to a priority. It also allows for meaningful, active participation.
Randy, I don't mean to interrupt you. Could you back up just to hear from the microphone?
Oh, sure. You bet.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. You bet. So it also brings meaningful, active participation. Active participation is a mandate requirement between the Elected Committee of Blind Vendors and the state licensing agency, which is the Oregon Commission for the Blind. So the proposed legislation not only brings the state statute in line with the federal Randall Shepherd Vending Stand Act, but it also, I believe, does some other fine-tuning and housekeeping provisions, including requiring that the state licensing agency, the Oregon Commission for the Blind, provide a annual report to the Legislative Assembly. I do want to share with you a couple of points. The Randall Shepherd Vending Stand Act, the federal equivalent of the Business Enterprise Program here in Oregon, is the most successful employment program for people people who are blind in the history of the United States. There are thousands of blind entrepreneurs running their own businesses across this land, and so it's just, you know, one job is so important when there's a 70% unemployment rate, and we're so proud of our entrepreneurs, and we want to take like examples from like Tennessee, where I visited recently. We've gone to Tennessee and we've seen what kind of program they have there. They have 100 managers blind running entrepreneurial businesses. Here in Oregon, we have 14. We look at Tennessee. They have a robust, vibrant training and recruitment program. There's people ready to take on locations. Here in Oregon, we don't have that. You look at Tennessee, and they have active participation. They have meaningful working together. Sometimes they don't always agree, but they work together to solve the problem and grow the program. Here in Oregon, we don't have that. I believe with this proposed legislation, we can be Tennessee. You know, we'll keep our name as Oregon, but we can make this program successful. We can put blind people to work, not 14, but 50. And we can work together to collaboratively, you know, make that happen. Again, I'm here in support of this Senate bill. And with that, I thank you for your time.
Great. Thank you very much. And Art, have you already spoken?
Nope.
All right. Well, welcome, Art. It's good to see you again, old friend.
Senator Gelser, it's a pleasure to be here. I want to thank you for having a public hearing on this bill. I know you have been a longtime advocate for people with disabilities and employment opportunities, and make sure that blind people are treated fairly and equitably in society. And so I first want to thank you for all you've done for the disabilities communities, because you are a true advocate for protecting the rights of Oregonian citizens who have disabilities. Senators, my name is Art Stevenson. I'm a blind licensed manager in a vending program here in Oregon. I, like Randy, have been in the program for over 30 years, and I'm very grateful that I'm one of the lucky ones. The blind community has an unemployment rate of 70%, as Randy mentioned, which is truly unacceptable, because with the proper training and education, blind people can do almost everything that sighted people can do. They just do it differently. And as Randy said, one of the ways that the United States and the different states across this great land have provided business opportunities and employment opportunities for blind people and people with multiple disabilities is the Randolph Shepherd Vending Program. It's been a very successful program across the country, putting blind people and other people with disabilities to work. In fact, here in Oregon, in our different facilities, we have 15 managers, but we also have, I believe it's 7 or 8 employees who are also disabled with other disabilities, blindness, etc. And that's a great thing, because, you know, as blind entrepreneurs, we know the capability of people with disabilities, not just people who are blind, but with all sorts of disabilities. And we want to make sure that they get employment. We want to make sure that this state invests in the independence of people with disability, not the dependence, because once they become independent, they become taxpayers. They don't have to rely on other sources to live and to work. And so this legislation, as Randy said, the vending program here in Oregon has dwindled down to 15 blind license managers, while other states, not just Tennessee, Washington, California, Nevada, Texas, New Jersey, and the Alabama, the list just goes on, where they put, you know, hundreds of blind people to work. And we've dwindled down to 15. When I started in this program, it was 36. And that's why we're here. We're here to strengthen the legislation, to make sure that all the business opportunities that are out there and available for blind people and other people with disabilities are taken advantage, so that we can put these people to work, us to work, and you know, create more jobs with other people with disabilities. I want to state that one of the ways that we have been able to remain competitive in the state of Oregon is that we've been allowed to partner with subcontractors, which has strengthened our program, because these business partners have better resources. They're bigger companies, and so they get better pricing on products. But let it be known that our subcontractors work for us. We don't just sit in a room and wait till the checks come. Our business partners, we work together at running our facilities. We engage with building management. We go out and we do things like have tasting parties for healthy choices, because that's the trend, and a lot of people don't realize that healthy snacks do taste good and stuff, and so our teaming partners go out with us and we do taste tests and all that. So I just want to say, no matter what you hear, the blind licensed managers, if they have subcontractors, they are the boss. They are controlling the business. Our partners know the capabilities of blind people, and they work with us. In fact, they support more jobs for blind people, and that's why they became our partners, because they believe in blind people. And we are partners. So anyways, I urge all of you senators to make these critical adjustments to the vending, the Minnie Randolph Shepherd Act here in Oregon. Help us create more jobs for blind people, and you know, more blind Oregonians can be fortunate like me.
Thank you so much.
I'm one of the 30%. Thank you very much.
We really appreciate it. Are there any questions for this panel? I've seen none. You've both done a great job. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And next we have James Edwards and Ronald Hurd, please. And then I just wanted to mention, I've seen small children coming in and out. Small children are always welcome in the room. Kids should always be seen and heard. So don't feel like you need to take them out of the room. It's wonderful to have people here. Please welcome.
Good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to speak, Chair and Committee. My name is James Edwards. I am from the city of Lakeside. I'm the president of the American Council of Blind of Oregon. And I'm here to speak on behalf of the American Council of the Blind of Oregon in support of Senate Bill 841. I am familiar with the Oregon Commission for the Blind and with the Business Enterprise Program, both as a participant. I served a term as commissioner in 2009 and 10, and as an observer stakeholder as president of ACBO for the last 8 years. Our purpose as a consumer organization of 150-plus members of Blind Oregon citizens is to advocate for the rights and welfare of the blind. Randolph-Shepard Act, under which the Business Enterprise Program operates, gives those who choose to take advantage of it an opportunity to create their own business, nourish and expand it, and ultimately, through hard work, reap the benefits. However, over the many years this program has been in place, it has not been without issues. The statutes that govern it seem to impede growth of the program, prompting Mr. Howe to closely examine statutes and, through his many years of experience in the program, identify some key elements of the statutes that, if implemented, will help the administration of this program be more effective and efficient, creating an opportunity for quality employment for blind individuals in Oregon, helping them to successfully pursue the American dream. The Randolph-Shepard Act was created in 1936 solely for the purpose of enhancing employment opportunities for trained, licensed blind persons to operate facilities in federal and other properties, and to make them self-supportive and productive members of our society. The program is a great success in many states, generating a national average income of $56,000. We want Oregon's program to become an exemplary program, one we can all be proud of. We believe the proposed legislation will help us make that happen. Uh-huh. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Good afternoon, Senator Mona Sanderson, Senator Gessler, Senator Olson, and Senator Dembrough. My name is Ronald R. Hurd. I'm an attorney from Hillsborough, Oregon. Excuse me. I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you today on behalf of the proposed amendments to ORS Chapter 346 as contained in Senate Bill 841. As the attorney who drafted the model amendments to Chapter 346 that Legislative Council is currently reviewing, I was asked to appear before this committee to answer any questions you have about the proposed amendments and to summarize briefly why the proposed amendments are needed and how the proposed amendments address those needs. I think it's important for me to give a brief history of the federal Randolph-Shepard Act and the Oregon mini Randolph-Shepard Act.
Can I just clarify, are you talking about amendments that have been drafted to the bill, or the bill is an amendment to the current statute?
Okay, so it's my understanding, and I'm not an expert in how legislation is passed, but Legislative Council originally took some suggestions that the blind vendors had. They turned it into a bill, but it was, in my opinion, it didn't do anything close to what needs to be done and what the blind vendors. So I took that standard mechanism for creating new amendments to legislation and drafted a brand new one, which a mother's note was issued, and that was given to Legislative Council. They're okay. Addressing that right now. And it's my understanding you guys don't have a copy of that. So
that's correct.
Okay. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. Thank you.
Okay. This is my first time. So.
You're doing great. Thank you.
A litigator, and I get to talking pretty fast sometimes. So I apologize. This program isn't well understood, and it's not a very big thing relative to lots of other programs in state government. So I think it's understandable that most legislators haven't had exposure to it even and don't understand where it comes from and how it operates. So let me just say this as brief history. In 1936, President Roosevelt passed the Randolph-Shepard Act, which is named after two senators, one from West Virginia, Senator Randolph, and Senator Shepard from Texas. And the RSA embodied a very simple idea. Its purpose was to assist one of the most underserved and vulnerable populations in American society, blind American citizens. It provided this assistance by creating a simple legal scheme that encouraged blind citizens to become self-employed and financially self-sufficient. The mechanism to accomplish that admirable goal was equally simple. The scheme created a statutory mandate directed to the heads of maintenance of all properties and buildings of all federal agencies and departments. The mandate provided that those heads of maintenance would provide vending facility opportunities on all federal properties where those types of facilities and equipment could otherwise properly and satisfactorily operate. Properly and satisfactorily operate is a very important concept in both the federal and state schemes. And by properly and satisfactorily, what was meant and the concerns that the federal legislature had were that they had sufficient space and utilities and a need for vending facilities. In other words, so long as there was otherwise adequate space, proper ventilation, electricity, and plumbing, the mandate required that the departments, the heads of maintenance of all the various departments and agencies would allow blind vendors to come in and set up their wares. Okay? So a big part of the confusion about this statute and the mini Randolph-Shepard Act is that the state agencies don't purchase anything from the blind vendors. And the language that talks that way in the existing statute is actually an artifact from 1956 when the Oregon Minnie Randolph Shepherd Act was codified. And at that time, ORS 346 did four basic things. It covered the vocational rehabilitation services that the Oregon Commission for the Blind gave to those it served. It dealt with Oregon schools for the blind and the deaf. And then it had two programs for adult blind Oregonians. And those were the Blind Industries and the Blind Vending Facility Program. The Blind Industries has been repealed. Okay? So when you see existing language that talks about buying products, that's what it's talking about. But those no longer exist in Oregon. We don't have the Industries for the Blind Program. So there are no products to buy. The services are the blind vending facilities, but they're not purchased by any state or federal agency. It's just they're required to allow them to come in. Okay, so.
And I'm going to have to ask you to summarize because we're almost out of time for this bill. So thank you.
Okay, so the bottom line is that, unfortunately, until 1974 and 1975, when certain amendments were made, these artifacts, these historical artifacts in the legislation, weren't cleaned up. So these amendments are designed, the ones I drafted, are designed to bring the Oregon Minnie Randolph Shepherd Act in sort of congruence and compliance with the existing federal act, which incorporates, as of 1975, all the modern things that the blind vendors were asking you to consider to help promote and expand this program. So if you have any questions somewhere at a later date and you'd like me to address the specifics, I'm happy to come back and do that.
Do you know when the amendments that you talked about might be available? Because I heard you say the bill does not do anything close to what you had wanted the bill to
do. No, the bill is drafted by Legislative Council didn't, but I think the one that I submitted to Legislative Council that got the mother's note does precisely what we would like it to do.
Right, but since we haven't seen that yet, we can't, take action on that.
You'd have to ask them and their lobbyist when. I'm not sure.
All right. Very good. Are there any other questions for this panel?
No, thank you.
Nope. Seeing none. Thank you both very much. Is there anybody else that wants to be heard on Senate Bill 841? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 841. Back to our agenda. So moving back up to the work sessions, we are going to... let's open up a work session on Senate Bill 833. And Fran and Sarah, do you want to come up? So, colleagues, this bill is not ready to go today. This is the, we had a hearing. This is the bill that would allow the release form to be provided to survivors of suicide and family members of those with a completed suicide at the hospital to be contacted by a support group or peer support agency. That came back with a $24 million fiscal on it. And so
the gasp.
So the health authority is here to talk about why. Breaking news is that Lines for Life would still like the amendment where they have the ability to call back. So we're working on getting that drafted, and we will explain why we will need to make some other changes in how a permission slip led to a $24 million fiscal, which is very sobering.
And
so welcome.
Madam Chair, before we begin, this is the bill where there was some question about how early that notification could happen, that initially it was upon release, wasn't it?
And, correct.
And we wanted amendments that allowed it to be earlier.
Earlier, yes.
And so has that happened?
So for reasons you're about to hear, we're probably not going to have this release at the hospital, so that becomes a little bit... It would be wonderful if we could get to a place where that was practical, but Fran will tell us a story that set me up for a pretty sad weekend.
Thank you.
Senator Gelser, Vice Chair Olson, and members of the committee. My name is Frances Purdy. I'm the Family Partnership Specialist with Integrated Health Systems and Oregon Health Authority. And I work with the adult unit in peer support as well. So just so you know, I'm not just speaking about family support. So this bill actually does three things, or at least it started out doing three things. Law enforcement referral after an individual had attempted suicide and a referral to peer support. A law enforcement referral to the families after a death has occurred by suicide. And then the third part being a connection with peer support after hospitalization for suicide. So I'll in terms of statistics, what we're talking about is in 2015, there were 762 Oregonian citizens that died by suicide. There were 2,000 hospitalized with that associated behavior. And specifically, for those people under the age of 24, we're talking about 529 suicide-related hospitalizations and 84 suicide deaths. So if that can help you know what the numbers that we're dealing with. And of course, we don't have an accurate, totally accurate reporting system. So those are the documented cases. Those are not those that kind of slip through the crack, like somebody who does an overdose, for instance, and may not be flagged as a suicide. So in terms of law enforcement referral for peer support after an attempt, there's a likelihood to be a two-week to a 90-day delay before the individual actually can access treatment. And that delay is caused by, in part, because treatment is often not available post an assessment, that the survivor may actually not have insurance, or if they do, they may not be on Medicaid and therefore not afford the copay. The idea of a peer support specialist is that they would immediately call back and promote that connection, not just a one-time connection, but an ongoing connection to navigate the system, to teach self, to coach self-management, to hopefully model hope that a person can live through it. And also continue the advice and the implementation of lethal means counseling and safety planning, because lethal means counseling doesn't just happen once. People start seeing nuances of it's not just locking up the gun. It also means looking at other means. So in terms of law enforcement after death by suicide, law enforcement referral. First of all, grief or bereavement is a natural process. And if you have a referral to a mental health agency or a referral to a drug treatment, that may not deal with the grief, because grief is natural. And grief is not something that just goes away. It comes back. Parents often talk about it as grief storms. You go along and then you're fine for a couple of months, and all of a sudden you remember something and the grief comes back. So bereavement counseling, the idea with peer support is that it goes on a long time, but it is at the request of the individual. Do you want me to even talk about post-hospitalization?
No, I think if you just get to the to the punchline of
the punchline
of the big fiscal.
So, what happens with the gaps of in 833 is that peer support right now is only provided as a Medicaid billable service. It is not available. Commercial insurance doesn't cover peer support services in this state, and even for Medicaid, peer support can only be billed through an approved billing agency, and that billing, and then in addition to that, there has to be a treatment plan, a diagnosis, and a treatment plan for peer support to be billed. And in fact, very few, in fact, few of our peer support agencies are associated with a billing agency for Medicaid. So a referral from a law enforcement agency, I mean a law enforcement individual, is going to be insufficient to kick in Medicaid, which is one of the problems. So while the law enforcement, while OHA can provide a referral source, a list, when the person looks at the list and they call, there will be no service because we don't fund it. It's not billable to Medicaid, and private insurance doesn't pay for it.
And just to clarify, what this really is kind of crystallizes the conversation that we've been having for the last few years and what we heard from consumers across the state when we did the statewide listening tour. You go into a crisis, you lose a child or a spouse to suicide, you yourself attempt suicide, and you can't access services to help in that time of crisis because it could be a many-month wait to even get in, and there may not be any mechanism by which you can get in, and if you can get in, there may be nobody to pay for it.
Right. And we have learned that from the emergency division, emergency department diversion project funded in the Child and Family Unit, that when we can put a peer support specialist right there at the emergency room to carry the family, to do that care coordination, that stabilizing, the grief work, we've had less than 5% return to the emergency department, but that's not funded right now by Medicaid. That's not funded by commercial insurance. It's funded out of general funds that the legislature approved. One of the last things I'd like to address is that payment is necessary in order to have a workforce that's reliably present with safe and appropriate services. Volunteers are wonderful. Volunteers are often not available when law enforcement comes onto the scene. The other thing is that peer support can be relied upon to be there and to have that consistent training so that you don't get somebody's interpretation of what they need. There's actual supervision, there's certification, there's competency. In closing, I think every suicide is preventable if we get there quickly, and especially with suicide attempts. We know that the window of opportunity is very short before there's another attempt. So SB 33 is one step forward to making suicide preventable. Thank you.
Any questions or?
So the big fiscal is because it's a major expansion?
The big fiscal, as I understood it after our conversation, is that basically it would be the wrong thing to do to say to a person in crisis, sign this form so someone can call and help you if we know that nobody can call to help you. So if we were going to do that, to set up the adequate resources for each of these individuals who has attempted suicide or has a loved one who has completed a suicide to get that initial phone call, our infrastructure is so undeveloped that it would cost $24 million to be able to do just that.
If we went statewide.
Yeah.
Because the other option is to slowly develop that. And the other thing is the gap in services, and we're talking anywhere from 2 weeks to 90 days to get an appointment.
After you've attempted suicide.
Right. And somebody's got to be there when the triggers are there that the person attempts again. Otherwise, we pay for it at the emergency department.
It's pretty sobering. We have a lot of work to do in our mental health system.
Thank you.
But thank you
Chair.
Very much for coming back and for a really great explanation. And I think your point is a really good one. It would be great for people to get a phone call, but to offer that and never have the call come, or have the call come and say, "And we're really sorry, but there's nothing we can do for you," seems almost worse than...
Or it's a one-time call.
Yeah.
That's the other problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, so as I mentioned, we're going to take all that out. We will have an amendment at the request for Lines for Life to be able to make a connection with Lines for Life, and then we will bring that back. Any further comments on 833? All right, so we're going to close the work session on 833. Senate Bill 263 is going to get carried over. Many people have asked about that today. The stakeholders on that are working on it. It seems like we're really close to an amendment that everybody can agree to that will help make sure that kids have access to school all day. Uh-huh. And let's wait for, well, we can just, will somebody move for Senator Olson to have a chance to vote on these other two when he gets back? So we can just do that while we're all here. And just so that people know, there's a lot going on through the building. So as people are getting up and coming and going, it has nothing to do with your bill or a lack of interest. It's just people are being called to testify in other committees. So I'm going to open up a work session on Senate Bill 949.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 949 makes non-competition agreements in employment agreements or contracts for home care workers voidable by the home care worker. There is a dash one amendment which makes covenants to not solicit other employees or transact business with customers in an employment agreement between employer and home care worker voidable. The dash one amendment has a no revenue impact statement and a statement of no expenditure impact.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dimbrough.
I move to adopt the dash one amendments dated March 21st, 2017.
Senator Dimbrough moves to adopt the dash one amendments to Senate Bill 949 dated March 21st of 2017. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Madam Chair, I move to adopt the dash three amendments dated...
Oh, that's a different bill.
That's a different bill. Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 949 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
He did.
He got the date right.
Yeah.
He got the date right, yeah.
Okay.
He just switched to a different screen. We're good.
Okay.
We're good. You want to start over on your motion?
Sure. I move Senate Bill 949 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Dimbrough moves Senate Bill 949 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. I'll carry that one. Oops, I'm dropping gavels. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 949 and open up a work session on Senate Bill 314.
Chair Gelser, I move to adopt the dash three amendments dated March 29th, 2017.
Could I just have the summary of the dash threes,
please? Oh, sure. Would you like me to do the whole summary or just the dash threes?
Why don't you do the whole summary so we know what we're voting on?
All right. Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 314 directs the Oregon Early Learning Division to establish relief nursery programs in all counties to provide services to at-risk children. It requires programs to be certified by the Oregon Association of Relief Nurseries. It describes the requirements for the use of funds. It requires the Association of Relief Nurseries to enter into contracts with local relief nursery programs. It excludes statutory forfeiture proceeds from the calculation of community matching funds, and it defines terms. The Dash 3 Amendment modifies the definition of relief nursery programs, including developing a tracking through a Association of Relief Nurseries database. It removes the definition of trauma-informed services and the mandate to provide those services. It requires relief nursery programs to be consistent with the early learning system, and it requires relief nursery programs to participate in the Association of Relief Nurseries statewide evaluation. And it clarifies the funding for certified programs may include administrative costs and specified direct service costs. And it declares emergency and is effective on passage. We have, for the Dash 3, a fiscal light, so a hall pass, so that we can move it to the Ways and Means Committee, and then a statement of no revenue impact.
Thank you. Senator Olson.
Chair Gilster, I move to adopt the Dash 3 amendment stated 3/29/17.
I think we actually did that.
You did that already?
Well, you made the motion, but we didn't vote on it because then we waited to hear what the bill was about.
Right. Oh, so he doesn't have to move
weird.
It again.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, so
yeah.
Senator Dimbrough moved that we adopt the Dash 3 amendment stated 3/29/2017 to Senate Bill 314.
And so did I, by the way. So.
Yes, it's been well moved. It's been well moved. We're all very moved. We've all been very moved by this amendment. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Would either of you like to make the final motion?
I defer to the Vice Chair.
Chair Gilster, I move Senate Bill 314 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Senator Olson moves Senate Bill 314 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered, and that does not need a carrier because it's going to Ways and Means. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 314.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to move that the rules be suspended to go back to reopen the work session on Senate Bill 949 to allow Senator Olson to vote on Senate Bill 949.
Senator Dimbrough moves the rules be suspended so Senator Olson can vote. Is there any objection? So I'll reopen the work session on Senate Bill 949. Senator Olson, how would you like to vote?
I vote aye.
Senator Olson votes aye. Thank you. And we'll close the work session on Senate Bill 949. And we'll open up a public hearing on Senate Bill 687. We didn't vote on it. We talked about it.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senate Bill 687 exempts delay or refusal to vaccinate a child from the definition of abuse for the purposes of child abuse reporting statutes. And there is a sub-referral to the Committee on Health Care.
Great. All right. Let's start with Brittany Ruiz, Bob Snee, and Sarah Gobe. And if I have mispronounced names, I apologize. I missed. Hello.
Hi there.
Come here.
Take him out with mine.
Maybe I'll make it. And as I said,
children are welcome
and should be heard and seen always.
I don't think you'd be able to hear me over mine. So.
bring that little guy right up here.
Hey, look it. Grandpa out there wants to say hi to you.
Oh, man.
I gotta name them, otherwise he doesn't feel comfortable, right?
Oh, I got you good.
Mine's super short. Say hi, bud.
Yeah,
he's a really wonderful
she's gonna start
legislator. Okay, you ready? Okay. All right, most of you know me actually.
For the record, we have all these crazy rules around here. You have to start with your name.
My name is Brittany Ruiz and I'm a mother of three beautiful kids and I'm here to testify in support of SB 687. I also happen to co-author that with Mr. Bob Snee, who's here. First of all, I want to thank Madam Chairwoman, Senator Gelser, that despite her heavy legislative schedule, her unwavering focus on the improvement of care for our children, recent reports on DHS, she scheduled this hearing. I would also like to thank Vice Chair Senator Olson, who made time to meet with me on this bill and requested a hearing several times.
Yes, he did.
Grandpa did.
Yeah, Grandpa. Thank you, sir. Thank you as well, members of the committee, for reading and listening to my testimony. As you may have heard, I became a safety care provider for my mother, whose baby was removed from her arms not more than 12 hours after the baby was born by DHS, with four armed policemen. The reason was because a pediatrician at a Portland hospital was not happy about that the mother declined both a Hep B shot and vitamin K at birth. His statement was, "If you don't vaccinate, I will call DHS." DHS caseworker then told the hospital to give whatever vaccines they wanted to before even getting a signed judge's order. The hospital decided to not only give the 5-pound baby with a broken arm due to breach delivery, Hep B and vitamin K, but also treated the baby as if she was infected with Hep B and gave her two additional Hep B immunoglobulin shots, not just one. The mother informed them that she was a military baby, or as she said, brat, and had received more vaccines than any other person she knew. The baby was not at risk. In fact, the social worker that came in before the pediatrician said that the mother was a great mother and was okay to be released. Medical records prove that. The story went viral with over 20,000 views on social media within 24 hours. Two attorneys jumped on pro bono after hearing the story and are still representing this mother today. When the mother joined back up with the baby after 4 days apart, both the baby and the mother cried. Sorry, I'm a little teary-eyed. Everyone else in the room watching this cried. The foster mother left her a note stating that she would give the baby pain meds because the baby was upset and crying and thought it was the broken arm. The baby did not cry once while she was joined with her mother, would nurse on demand, and was the happiest baby I ever saw. It changed me then and there, and I knew at that moment I had to change our system. It took almost 2 months before the court decided in this mother's favor, and DHS decided to drop the case because the mother was exceptional. Meanwhile, the mother and I met U.S. Congressman Bonamici and shared her story. Bonamici was floored that this occurred in Oregon by DHS, and I also included a photo that you can see of that meeting. The mother, while in my care, would cry daily and would be scared that DHS was still going to come and take her baby. I've remained in touch with her, and she continues to complain of nightmares and very scared that she will wake up and her daughter is gone. Wasted resources. Three court-appointed attorneys for this case because a baby was involved, the boyfriend and her, four safety care providers, baby and mother given OHP plus by DHS, drivers given to the mother for visitations, taking easily 5 to 6 hours out of their day for this, sent a drug addiction specialist who said the visit was unnecessary, and DHS caseworker lied about why the visit was necessary. DHS demanded weekly nurse visits. Both DHS drivers said, I don't understand why this family is being treated like this. To me personally. Per DHS spokesman Gene Evans, who told Oregon Live, state law and agency policy require child welfare workers to ensure that children in department custody get their shots. We live in an era where parents are truly scared to bring their kids to the doctor because they don't want to have DHS called because they're deciding to follow a different vaccination schedule than the current untested CDC schedule. Why does DHS now have a reputation as the doctor-nurse henchman for vaccinations? Most parents who decide not to vaccinate or delay vaccination have arrived at that decision very carefully, either due to other siblings being injured by either the vaccine or the vaccine schedule, now 52 doses by age 6, and I included the schedule so you can see, but in case you didn't see that, you can see that this is 2016, that was 1983, that was 1960. That's a lot of vaccines. That's by age 18. Or researching for hours and hours and came to that decision. After helping this mom and having many other parents reaching out to me with similar stories, I showed up with my kids to my senator's office and asked to meet with him on something that really affected our family. He had a book day but sat down with me, heard my story, and asked me if I would like to submit legislation to improve this. And here I am today. I do sincerely believe that DHS will save at least 20% of their funds and resources not following up false claims by adding the small amendment to this bill. We have already heard about the report last week that Senator Gelser blew the whistle on and the year before, which shows that DHS is not following up on real abuse cases or handling things in a timely fashion. This will give them more time, funds, and resources to address real abuse cases, not false flags. I hope with all my heart that you vote for a do pass recommendation. I appreciate your time and you listening to my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Thank you, Chairwoman Gelser, and members of the committee. My name is Robert Snee, and I'm an attorney in Portland, and I consult with individuals regarding vaccine rights. I'm also the co-chair of Oregonians for Medical Freedom, a nonpartisan grassroots organization dedicated to preserving a patient and parent's right to informed consent for any and all medical procedures, including vaccinations. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you in favor of Senate Bill 687. I was just a little over 8 months old when President Eisenhower gave a prophetic farewell speech prior to President Kennedy taking over his leadership of this country. That speech is famous for Eisenhower warning to the American people to remain knowledgeable and alert to monitor potential abuses of power by the military-industrial complex. His concern was that power could endanger our liberties. Eisenhower warned we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence and that the potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. He also stated the power of money is ever-present and gravely to be regarded. Most significant for today's hearing was his warning to be alert to the danger that public policy could itself become the captive of a scientific technological elite. Eisenhower's warnings are no less important today when he spoke them 56 years ago, but the influence of the military-industrial complex has been vastly overshadowed by the influences of the medical-industrial complex. Our everyday lives, everywhere you turn, You can see, feel, and hear the influences of the medical industrial complex from the numerous print ads we see and to the seemingly endless commercials for pharmaceutical products. Walk into any Safeway store with a pharmacy, and you can save 10% on your grocery bill if you get a flu shot that day. Insurance companies like Blue Cross will give doctors a $400 annual bonus for each patient under two if a certain percentage of their patients are fully vaccinated. For a pediatrician with just 200 patients, that's an extra $80,000 a year. It's an all-or-nothing bonus, which is why many parents who choose not to vaccinate or delay vaccinations are being fired by their doctors and forced to seek care elsewhere. Even the media has helped create a culture of ridiculing those who are vaccine risk aware and seek greater vaccine safety, as well as disrespecting and dismissing those who have children that have suffered vaccine injury. Most significant, though, is the influence of the literal thousands of paid lobbyists for the pharmaceutical industries that descended upon Capitol Hill last fall in a blitzkrieg to assure passage of the 21st Century Cures Act. Lobbyists for the pharmaceutical industry outspend lobbyists for every other industry, including energy industries and military and defense industries. Regarding Senate Bill 687, just last year, an article was published in the Journal of Pediatrics, written by three doctors, urging a modification of medical ethics. The article states that if doctors are unable to essentially bully, coerce, or harass patients into vaccinating their children after repeated attempts to get them to comply, then a doctor has a, quote, strict legal obligation to report child neglect to the local Child Health Protective Services agency. This is an attempt by that powerful medical industrial complex to change medical ethics away from the humanitarian foundation that has existed since the ancient Hippocratic Oath was created to a utilitarian view for the greater good of society. That viewpoint was soundly rejected by the vast number of nations in the world that have adopted the Nuremberg Code, and most recently, the Universal Declaration of Bioethics and Human Rights. This declaration was adopted by all 193 counties participating in the United Nations, including the United States, in 2005. Article 6 of that declaration states that individuals must give prior, free, and informed consent to any preventative, diagnostic, and therapeutic medical intervention. The sole interest of society is not more important than the rights of the individual. Even prior to that journal article being written, parents throughout the country and in Oregon have been and are being bullied, harassed, and threatened by their pediatricians with the removal of their children by DHS or CPS if they do not submit to the immediate vaccination of their children. Not only are they being harassed by doctors, but DHS in this state and others are wrongfully threatening parents with child abuse if they do not vaccinate their children, despite the parents' right to claim either religious or philosophical exemptions to those vaccines. Last summer, a woman from Grants Pass, Oregon, was referred to DHS by a doctor because she declined to give her newborn baby a hepatitis B shot prior to being discharged from the hospital. That vaccine contains aluminum, a known neurotoxin that, depending upon the baby's infant size, contains 10 to 15 times the amount of aluminum the FDA states is a safe amount. DHS came to her home and opened up an investigation because of that referral. And on June 14th, the mother was called into the DHS office and told that she had 2 weeks to vaccinate her child, and the caseworker implied that her baby would be taken away for child abuse if she did not comply. She was told that waiting a year to vaccinate her child, which is what she wanted to do, was unacceptable. Last February, James Meehan, a surgeon in Oklahoma, posted his story on social media about getting a tearful phone call from his own daughter who was being bullied and harassed at her first well baby visit because she too had declined the hepatitis B vaccine at the hospital. Dr. Meehan stated, "What happened in that pediatric clinic to my daughter happens to parents every day in Tulsa, in Oklahoma, and in America. It's unethical, it's unprofessional, and needs to be exposed to the abuse that it represents." Days prior to that story being posted, I consulted with a woman in Florida who was under investigation by their Child Protective Services for what amounted to be a false accusation. Prior to closing the caseworker demanded to see the immunization records for her three-month-old daughter, and she was told that not vaccinating is a big deal, and a new case would have to be opened regarding medical neglect. Ms. Ruiz earlier told you about the case last fall in Portland. In that case, the hospital social worker reported that everything was appropriate to discharge the baby to the mother, her only concern being the lack of a child seat, which was being provided for. DHS was called 12 hours after the baby's birth as a result of the doctor's report and took temporary custody of the child. Within 20 minutes, Prior to any court hearing approving the temporary custody, the baby was given not only a vitamin K shot, but the hepatitis B vaccine and the immunoglobulin shots that Ms. Ruiz talked about. I've also provided you a copy of a 2012 article relating a story that was republished in the Vax Truth blog with the headline, Indiana Doctor Tells Mom, Be Compliant, Vaccinate or I'll Call CPS. Oregon parents need to be protected from the abuse of power by the medical industrial complex. The current Oregon law defines child neglect to include the failure to include medical care. But to protect the civil rights of Oregonians, it's necessary and proper that the definition should be amended to state the refusal or delaying of vaccination by itself alone does not constitute child neglect. I urge a do-pass recommendation on Senate Bill 687. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Snee. Welcome.
Hi. Good afternoon, Senator Gelser and members of the Senate Committee on Human Services. My name is Sarah Sultani Gobay. I am a mother of three and a constituent of District 17. I had written my testimony originally in support of SB 687, but decided I'd rather share a story that happened to me just a few nights ago. At 1 a.m., Ty here woke up screaming. He's 15 months old, and I assumed it was from a dairy infection that I had had that evening and that he had gotten it via my breast milk, and I believed it was causing him digestive distress. After 30 minutes of being unable to console him, he started shallow, rapid breathing, and it was unlike anything we'd ever seen before, and my husband and I were immediately freaked out. He wanted to go to the ER, and I was traumatized. I was like absolutely paralyzed in fear because of the thought that of the what ifs that could happen if we did go to the ER. Were they going to question me? And actually, I'll just keep reading. All the cases of medical kidnapping that I've heard about in Oregon, especially, had come to my mind. And the bullying I was sure to endure from the hospital staff after being asked, is he up to date on his immunizations? And replying, no, he's not up to date. We don't vaccinate. It doesn't matter that this was my healthiest child by far, has only had one cold in his life, and has never had an ear infection or antibiotics. The intake nurse looked appalled. I mean, she was disgusted with us. And I mumbled something about my oldest child having a vaccine injury and our doctor, our pediatrician recommending we no longer vaccinate due to our family medical history and genetic single nucleotide polymorphisms making us more prone to adverse reactions. Thankfully, she was the only one who gave me a hard time that night. And his oxygen levels were at 100%. And the ER doc was fabulous and agreed that it was probably digestive distress and that dairy was probably the culprit. But what if something else was actually seriously wrong and we didn't take him in due to fear? Fear that they would call DHS or CPS and call on me because we don't vaccinate. Fear that I was going to get into a verbal altercation with a hospital staff and be made to look like a crazy person. I've been dealing with these fears and being labeled an anti-vaxxer since my 16-year-old's last booster 11 years ago that resulted in injury. Nearly every medical-related appointment for all three of my children has been met with anxiety solely because we no longer vaccinate. SB 687 would offer parents like me some peace of mind and afford us the opportunity to seek medical treatment for our children where otherwise we might be too afraid to, due to being discriminated against and despite Oregon law protecting our decisions. Thank you for taking the time to hear my testimony today. I'm sorry, he was quite squirmy.
He was quite perfect. Thank you very much. Are there any questions for this panel? Say bye. Oops, seeing none. And if he wants to say something in the microphone, that's
fine. Did you want
to
say something? Can you say hi?
Hi.
Oh, that's really good.
What's your son's name?
His name is Ty Valor Gobay.
Cool.
Welcome to the legislature, Ty.
Thank you very much. 15 months old. Thank you.
Next up, we have Paula Bryant, Faith Trincy, and Amber Sims. And again, my apology about pronunciations.
Will you sit in the middle, please?
Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for this opportunity.
Chairwoman Geltzer, really appreciate the panel here, all the committee members. It's nice to see Senator Denbrough here, my man. We see you at the coffee chats, and it's great to have such an open format for community discussion. Really appreciate it. This is my first time, only my second time testifying at all, and my first time in front of you. So I'll just share what I've written. I support this.
Start with your name.
Oh, I'm sorry. Of course.
Okay.
Right. Paula Bryant-Terise, and this is my daughter, Faith. I brought her here today because, I wasn't going to make it back in time, and there's no caregiver that's competent to take care of her without me. So I'll continue. I support this bill, Senate Bill 687, because it gives clarity to DHS caseworkers and protection for families like mine. Although many doctors don't acknowledge it, one thing the science has settled is that vaccines, like every other medical procedure, can cause harm. In those cases, like mine, my daughter, Faith, would not qualify for the narrow criteria that Oregon Health Authority recognizes as a valid medical exemption, as her adverse event was not anaphylaxis. Can you hear me okay?
I can, and you can actually back up a little bit from the microphone because it's really powerful.
I can't tell.
You're doing great.
Okay. My daughter was typically developing child up until her 18-month vaccines, after which she lost all speech, eye contact, gross and fine motor skills, and began growling, hitting herself, and chewing on her clothes. She lost all ability to engage in a meaningful way, as our developmental pediatrician stated. Obviously, our family was devastated, as you would expect. As her parents, sorry, I'm trying to get choked up.
You're doing great, and take your time.
As her parents, along with her doctor, we decided it would be negligent and dangerous to administer any more vaccines to our daughter. We filed a claim in Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. So in order to protect my daughter from further harm, we used the vaccine exemptions allowed us under Oregon law. 2 years ago, I received a call from DHS that received a complaint about my in regards to my daughter. I was terrified for the weeks it took them to investigate our case. For weeks, we lived with fear that our girl would be taken away from us.
Can you sit up straight, please? Sit up straight. Good.
Fortunately, our case was resolved, and we have many teachers, neighbors, and our county social worker who could vouch for us. I know there are many children who are neglected and sadly need saving from their parents, but we need to make sure that the determining factors used to assess neglect don't ensnare children whose parents are rightfully and lawfully protecting their children from harm. Her behavior, due to her injury, makes her a target for reporting to DHS. She sometimes screams and runs away from us. She scratches herself raw on her face, as you can see. She's pulled out her hair. Lots of reasons to, we stand out. Let's put it that way. I know firsthand the damage that overzealous public health can do to a family in the name of the greater good. I was going to go on to talk about my mother, who was put in a sanatorium for tuberculosis, but I'm omitting that. Just suffice it to say I have experience with removal and the devastation it does to a family, whether it's a parent or a child. I know from the research available that there's a financial incentive for pediatricians to vaccinate according to the CDC schedule. So I'm concerned about incentives that may be contributing to the removal of children from their homes. People like me are now afraid to seek medical attention due to the threat of doctors who've been indoctrinated into the idea that refusing a vaccine is negligent. I have many friends who've shared such stories with me. Just a couple of weeks ago, a health official testified here to many of you that vaccines should not be considered a personal medical choice. Oregon law does not support this. In light of such attitudes, however, I believe we need to protect the protection of this bill. This bill provides for families like mine. This bill would provide reassurance to parents like me that it's safe to take our children to the doctor when needed without risking their loss into a system that can never give them the love and care that they, a family can give to a child like mine. And we love our daughter very much.
We love our daughter very much.
That's true. The language in this bill will prevent mistaken removals and the clarity the mission DHS workers need. A recent DHS report showed that the caseworkers often misapplied or misunderstood state laws defining threats. This bill would aid the caseworkers and save the state money and legal expenses. As you can be sure, I would pursue every means possible to hold the state accountable for its actions should my daughter be removed. This bill would provide a clean and simple fix to a problem that exists. This will provide a measure of comfort for parents like me who currently fear taking my child to the ER urgent care for the very reasons I've outlined. Do you have any questions for anyone?
Thank you very much. We'll finish the whole panel and then we'll
Okay.
at the end.
I think...
My name is Faith Bryant-Terrize. Thank you for listening to my mom. I support SB 687. Please vote for this bill.
Thank you very much. You did great. Very well done. Very well done.
Thank you, Paula. Thank you, Faith. Thank you, Madam Chair and members of this important committee. My name is Amber Sims.
I love you.
I am here to testify also that I am in favor of SB 687. And I'm here today taking time off work, driving from Portland, to urge you to support this important clarification and relief that 687 offers countless Oregon parents and families who choose to delay or forego certain vaccines for health reasons. Including my family and many families I know personally here in this state, and the mother and child with which Brittany and others before me have testified on behalf of. Vaccine status should never be a reason for investigation by DHS, does not constitute child neglect, and is typically a thoroughly researched matter made by highly educated families and their doctors who take time to carefully review what's best for each child based on individual and family history. Sadly, for families like mine and many others, visits to the ER or urgent care centers cause extreme anxiety and fear for unnecessary repercussions from healthcare workers who are unfamiliar with and do not have all of the family medical history or knowledge about current science acknowledging genetic susceptibilities for vaccine injury, yet arrive at their own personal opinions and general recommendations and proceed to bully, intimidate, and coerce families with threats to call DHS simply over vaccination status, regardless of what state law rightfully protects. SB 687 would provide much needed clarity around an issue that is both a protected right and a private decision between a family and their regular doctor, and remove any unnecessary department resources toward a non-issue matter, allowing for taxpayer resources to be better spent on real cases of abuse here in Oregon, which the recent special department report highlighted. Thank you for hearing me today. Again, I strongly urge you to support SB 687 and this clarification of existing laws.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for this panel? No, thank you all so much for coming.
Thank you.
We really appreciate it. All right, next up we have Lisa, we have Lisa, and and we have Ashley. Ashley, thank you.
It's Sevcek. It's a Czechoslovakian name.
Sevcek.
So, yeah, I always say it's a good hockey name, so. But I don't play hockey. So.
Welcome.
Thank you. This is my first time here, so if I'm nervous, just excuse me a little bit. So.
And even though we just discussed the pronunciation of your name,
yes,
would you say it for the record again?
Yes. My name is Lisa Sevcek.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Chairwoman Gelser and members of the committee, my name is Lisa Sevchek, and I am a neighbor of Paula and Faith. I support this bill, and I urge you to do the same. I have lived next door to Paula and her family for over 10 years, and I agree wholeheartedly with her testimony. I saw firsthand the upset and the fear they experienced when a DHS complaint was made. It is an honor to know this family, to see the love and care and endless efforts they have given year after year after year to help Faith is beautiful, it's inspiring, and it's very humbling. To have this family threatened by a false and unjust complaint is not right, in my opinion. I feel that this bill, SB 687, would provide much-needed protection for families who, with good reason, delay and or decline vaccinations. Such a bill would help to prevent situations such as this situation experienced by Paula and her family. So please keep kids like Faith with their families, and please support this bill. And thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Hello, my name is Ashley Owl. I'm like super nervous, never done this before. I support this bill, 687. I would like to start out by saying thank you to the chairwoman and everyone else here for being here today and allowing me to speak out my story. So it's a very emotional story. It's not a pretty story, but it's mine. So I'm gonna share it.
And take your time, you don't have to rush.
Okay. So, I would also like to thank Brittany Ruiz for inviting me here today, for I'm afraid without her help in this hearing today, my story, like many others out there, would be lost to the world and unknown. I honestly don't even know where to start. But who wouldn't in a situation like this? So I will start with a little bit about my angel's birth. When Zoyne was born, I was not ready. I was 20 and terrified about being a mommy, but not because I thought I wasn't capable of being a great mother. No, I was terrified to finally be bringing my little girl into this room, into this world where mommy can't protect her. She no longer has a womb to hide in that's all comfy and cozy. Not to mention the fact that my personal childhood and life wasn't such a good example of what life can provide for a little girl. I was terrified that I would somehow lose her, that a man would come and treat her like me, that she'd be raped, put down, and hurt, because I personally know that the world isn't such a nice place. The one thing, however, that I never thought would happen is that the system put in place to protect those of us being mistreated would be the same system to abuse me and many others like me. Throughout my 21 short years of life, on July 31st, 2015, at 10:15 p.m., under the full blue moon, and also on my mother's birthday, I gave birth to the most beautiful, wonderful, and precious little being ever. I held 21 inches and 8 pounds and 7 ounces of pure innocence. I knew from that first moment two things. One, I would do anything to protect this child, and two, that I was not nearly as prepared as I thought. The first 2 months of Zwin's life, I spent doing a bunch of research on Oregon laws for immunizations, as well as the cause and effect of immunizations and certain disabilities. I researched not only American databases, but European databases as well. That's when I decided that I was going to delay immunizations for Zwin and spread them out. I didn't want to overload her little body. Furthermore, I didn't want one to react badly and then her doctor to spend precious hours guessing which one could it be. I know it's frowned upon not to give your children immunizations as specified by school districts and the government in general, so I found a good middle that I could work with. I was happy, and Zwin was happy too, or so it seemed. In December of 2016, I was sexually assaulted by my ex-husband. Shortly after, CPS was involved and we went to court. Judge Rainey out of Washington County ordered a 14-day safety plan. I carried out that safety plan. I moved and my daughter was to remain with Grandpa Reynolds, my father, until the 14th day. On the 14th day, instead of my little girl coming home to mommy, a CPS worker showed up at my father's home and removed my child. I'm sorry.
You're doing good. Feel free to take a minute. You're doing really well.
I'm so sorry. On the 14th day, instead of my little girl coming home to mommy, CPS workers showed up at my father's home at night and removed my child with two officers who said they would do so by force. This lady took my sleeping child out of her sleeping grandma's arms and laughed in my dad's face as she left. The following day, we had an emergency shelter hearing. CPS had no new evidence at the time, but my ex-husband, however, did. He said, his lawyer anyway, said that in 2012, my father was charged with four counts of sexual abuse towards a minor. CPS agreed to this statement. The case in which they are talking about is my personal case, where my father pressed charges against my sister's husband for sexually molesting and raping me for years. On that day, Judge Menchaca ruled to have my daughter placed in out-of-home care. The following Monday, we found out that that same day, my ex-husband's family got approved for an emergency approval, and my child was placed with the family of the man who sexually assaulted me in my apartment complex driveway. Or so I believe, because CPS is refusing to give any details other than she is with family, yet no one in my family has contacted me to tell me that she's with them. So where else would she be? I cannot believe it. Since then, CPS has done nothing to help me. They lied under oath after being sworn in when they didn't have to at the shelter hearing and said that I've never participated in services and that I was without adequate housing. CPS had issued ISRS workers in my home four times a week for over a month. They also helped pay for my new apartment. I've only seen my daughter five times in the last month and a half. I won't even have her for Easter. CPS won't even take her to her current pediatrician to continue her shots on the specified regimen that we had agreed. Because, like I said, I don't want to overload her little body. They won't even allow me to hold my child while they get her up to date on her immunizations because I wasn't fast enough. Hey. They didn't even tell me that they talked with the foster family and got my daughter a new pediatrician and not her current one, and finished her immunizations without a court order, without a judge signing paper, anything. It took me resending an email multiple times asking about this, asking about my child and her health because of the cuts all over her body when I see her at visits, because of the severity of the diaper rash that she has had over the last month and a half in the five visits I've seen her, because of the fact that her left eye was busted on our fourth visit and the CPS worker said something about it. I didn't even say something about it. Once again, someone gets to rape me, and the only difference this time is that I'm being raped of my rights as a mother instead of my flesh. I fully support all parents' rights to delayed immunizations or even not having to vaccinate. You don't go through hours of labor, vomit, diapers, and cries just to have your rights taken away. My name is Ashley Owl, and I'm the young mother of Zwinevere Owl, and I believe there needs to be a change. Thank you very much. And if I could potentially meet with Senator Gelzer afterwards, I would appreciate it to share more of my story, because I'm hoping to get my daughter back home before Easter, because there's no reason she shouldn't be with mommy. That's all I have to say.
Well, thank you so much for coming forward. I can't imagine...
I didn't picture 21 being like this.
Well, you're very powerful, and of course I'll meet with you after. And and I'm sorry for what you've been through. Are there questions for this panel? All right. So we're going to excuse this panel. Don't leave after the hearing, though. Okay. So we'll chat. My staff's on their way down. And next we have Jordan Ohid and Sarah Bacon.
afternoon. My name is Jordan Ort. I didn't spell that legibly, I'm sorry.
I also don't read very well, so.
Chairwoman Gessler and members of the Senate Committee on Human Services, thank you for your time. Excuse me. I'm here today to support SB 687. Let me tell you about a little bit about myself. I'm a realtor here in town with John L. Scott. I have my Bachelor's of Business Administration, Tourism and Hospitality Management, and I'm also a mother of two, Noah and Parker. They're not here today because it's their nap time right now. And so I became a mother 3 years ago when my son was born. Until that moment, I had not fully understood the great joy, but also responsibility of what it meant to be a parent. It means making hard choices. It means figuring out what kind of mother I want to be and how I want to guide my child through life so that one day he can go off on his own, make a way, and ultimately be a productive member of society. This is not something that I take lightly. My decisions on my family's medical choices should be made by my husband and myself, for what we choose is right for us. We should not live in fear that our medical choices will put our family in jeopardy just because we might want to delay or decline a medical procedure such as vaccinations. In Oregon, we have the option to a non-medical exemptions for our children, for school, for them to attend school. Delaying and or declining a vaccination should not be a reason to have CPS called on them, on someone, us or someone else. And if a choice is made under duress of that threat, then they have not given true informed consent. Where there's risk, there must be a choice. Just like any other medical procedure, there must be informed consent. My body, my choice, my children, my pride and joy, my responsibility, my choice. Making this choice is not abuse. It's not child abuse, and this bill will clear up any question otherwise. I respectfully ask you to vote yes on SB 687. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. Excuse me. My name is Sarah Bacon. I'm from Tigard, Oregon. And thank you so much, Senator Gelsler, and the rest of the committee for hearing this bill today. I know you've had a busy schedule and it was hard to fit it in. And I really appreciate your compassion and interest in this bill and in this issue. I'm a mother of three children. My oldest is almost eight. I have a five-year-old and a three-year-old. And just a little bit about me and why I'm here today and why I think this is important. I began researching medical decisions and particularly vaccinations before the birth of my first child. So it's been about 10 years. And I'm the type of person, I have a low pain tolerance. I don't like being sick. I don't like anything being wrong. I'll take a pill for anything. Used to be, I mean, you know, Tylenol, that kind of stuff. I probably would have been somebody who would have went ahead with my doctor's recommendations and fully vaccinated my children had I not just had a question, a simple question as to, you know, what's all this talk about vaccines? I wonder what's going on. I'm not pro-vaccine. I'm not anti-vaccine. I'm pro-truth and pro-information. So I took it upon myself 10 years ago to start researching the subject. And I started with three simple questions, just looking at, do people who not vaccinate their children regret it? Do people who vaccinate their children regret it? And what are the health outcomes? Are they the same? To kind of just, you know, start there. And since then, it's been 10 years, and I have not encountered any research that has prompted me to want to inject my children per the CDC schedule with the vaccines due to many reasons, and we're not here to discuss that today, but I just wanted a little background about my knowledge and my interest in the subject and why. But today, I want to talk about protecting human rights, parental rights, and ensuring that the true intent of the law is clear and not open to misinterpretation. I'm here to talk about the importance of SB 687, which clarifies that the definition of abuse does not include failure to vaccinate a child or the choice to delay vaccination. Now, you may feel that this small change in the wording of the law is not important or relevant or necessary to you, and maybe it isn't to you, but it is vitally important to me and tens of thousands of other loving, caring, and hardworking parents here in Oregon. And I say tens of thousands not to be dramatic, but back 2 years ago when we were dealing with another issue and Bill regarding vaccination, I did some research, and at that time when we were looking at removing children from school due to vaccination choices, I called the Oregon Health Authority to see how many children would be impacted if that law were to pass. And their information was 33,000 children across Oregon would have been denied an education due to declining or foregoing vaccinations. So literally tens of thousands of families this law affects is important to, including myself and many others here today. SB 687 provides a clear distinction in the law that delaying or declining vaccination for your child is not child abuse and protects parental rights to make informed medical decisions for their children without the threat of misinterpretation or abuse of the true intent of the law. It protects parents like me who love their children dearly and research and make the best informed decision for their children as possible with only the child's best interest in mind. SB 687 clearly leaves the definition of abuse in the law to be used on those who knowingly and intentionally inflict harm on their children. Now, there may be people out there that so fervently believe that the importance of all vaccinations that they may personally feel that it is a crime to delay or decline vaccination. I've heard that argument. And to those people, I say this. Life is not without risk. Everything we do carries with it a risk and a benefit. Every medical procedure and medicine carries with it its own set of risks and benefits, and vaccinations are no different. Last time I checked the vaccine adverse event reporting system back in 2015, there were 8,739 recorded deaths, 13,194 life-threatening reactions, 11,660 cases of permanent disability, 54,699 hospitalizations, and 284,973 emergency room visits reported due to vaccine since the establishment of VARS in 1990. On logic alone, the argument that not vaccinating your child should be considered a crime is fallible, because then would the converse be held true? If you're going to argue that the parent is criminally negligent for choosing to forego or delay a vaccination based on the fact that the parent is choosing an action or inaction that produced or could potentially produce a negative result, that would be the disease, then following the same logic, a parent who has had a child that experiences an injury or death due to vaccination, would they then also be held criminally negligent for the child's harm because the parent chose an action, vaccination, that resulted in the child's harm? That is cruel and not correct, because parents vaccinating their child were doing what they thought were best and with the best intentions for their children, and unfortunately and sadly had a negative outcome. And just as it would be cruel and wrong to hold an unvaccinating parent liable because they felt they were making the best decision for their child's well-being by choosing to forego or delay vaccination based on their research and educated decisions. I ask of you today to please support SB 687 and clarify in the law that failure to vaccinate or delay a vaccination is not child abuse. Please protect the true intent of the law and the true intent of parents, and work diligently to pass a simple but very important bill into law. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions for this panel? Nope, seeing none. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else that wants to be heard on? Totally up to anybody else whether they want to talk or not. Okay. So Stacey Ayers. Welcome.
I'm feeling a little unsure. Thank you. So my name is Stacey Ayers. I am the manager for the Child Protective Services Program for the department. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today. The only, it's hard to talk when there's been so much testimony provided about the concerns and some of the things that have been brought forward, I think are legitimate issues, clearly. So just really focus on the specific details in the change, the language that's provided, and just really be clear that the struggle that we have with the legislation as it's written is that we are not doctors at DHS, at our hotlines, and I wouldn't claim to have medical knowledge that would in some way supersede what the language in this bill provides. I would only say that if there are times where a physician calls us and says to us that by not providing a vaccination, perhaps a child would be in danger, aside from the parent's choice to make a decision about vaccinations, I'll just be clear, that should never result in us assigning a report. Simply the simple choice of a parent, whether or not they get their child vaccinated, should never result in an assignment for a CPS investigation. Regardless of whether somebody decides to call us or not is a different issue. It should never result in an assignment. Now, and I say that intentionally because we get these calls, and I'm familiar with them. I managed a hotline. I've managed people who receive the reports, and I've fielded those kinds of calls, and I've talked to the medical staff, and I've talked to different providers and hospitals about these kinds of issues, that the simple choice that a parent has about vaccinations and choosing not to is not child abuse. People get to make that decision. Similar to co-sleeping, and I think there's a lot of information out there about co-sleeping. I don't want to get into too much of that, but simply co-sleeping is not child abuse, right? I worry about the effect that this potentially has, and I would suggest that there are clearly ways that we can do better in our decision making at our hotlines and our screeners and our ability to make decisions and determine that things like this, that simple parent choice to not vaccinate, is not child abuse and should not be assigned. I can't say it enough. But I worry about the time where the doctor calls in and says, if they don't have this happen, which is these are the kinds of calls we do get, if this doesn't happen, this child's life is at risk. And the question would be then from the screener should be, is it just a parent choice or is there some other life-threatening condition or something else that is happening here to really get at kind of the true issue? And I guess I would just stop at that. If you have questions, I'm happy to take those questions.
Any questions from Mr. Ayers? Senator Olson.
You just mentioned that. You said if the doctor calls in and says if this does not happen, the child's life is at risk. Mm-hmm. Would that decision to continue be predicated only on that doctor, or would other doctors be consulted before that decision was given the credence and weight that it would be from just this one person?
So the Vice Chair Olson and Chair Gelser, The question would be as it would be to any mandatory reporter who calls in and says, I believe that what I'm seeing here is child abuse. The question should be from the screener, are you telling me that it is is this about a parent's choice to not get this, or is this somehow a life-threatening condition, and what is that life-threatening condition, right? So we would want to be able to have the doctor articulate that. Then the decision would be to assign. It would not be without precedent to get other medical experts. And I would imagine in many instances, people would be calling in and saying, or doctors would be saying, I have a different opinion about this life-threatening condition. That is not uncommon. That happens quite often. Generally, it's, we don't have a list of physicians at the hotlines that we call and say, hey, can you please tell me if you have a different opinion about that? Usually that comes out as part of a fact-gathering part of the assessment. Does that answer your question?
It kind of does, but I'll follow up.
Okay.
I guess my concern comes from the fact that if, in fact, you actually see child abuse, mm-hmm. that's one thing. But if you're talking about strictly vaccinations, That's another thing.
Agreed.
And if that doctor calls in and says, you know, they're not vaccinating, it's apparent
right.
that your agency has looked into this and put many, many, many people in fear of losing their child. And not only is the fear of the loss of the child and the mental distress that they receive because of it, but the financial stress that they receive because they have to defend themselves now. And I find it very unnerving to have this discussion after we've had other discussions. And I don't, you know, you seem to show concern over this bill. And is your concern that you don't like it or we don't need it?
Well, Vice Chair Olson and Senator Gelser, just to be clear, it is not that I don't like the bill. I think that if we could possibly modify the language. So this isn't the department opposing this legislation.
Right.
So it's not a matter of
neutral.
And it's not a matter of I have really no personal opinion. I believe that people have a right to make decisions whether they vaccinate or not. I know many people that don't vaccinate, so that is a parenting decision. Much in the same way, a doctor may provide to us information about certain life-saving measures. We have to make decisions about whether or not that in itself is considered medical neglect, and that's the only thing that I'm kind of parsing out here is I worry about the bill as written. And I think that there possibly are some modifications that could be made at this point. And that's the only clarification. It's not a matter of like or dislike. It's a matter of concern about the potential chilling effect it could have.
Oh, follow up. Just one last one.
Yeah.
I this is a difficult question for me because it bothers me. I've been here now since 2015, and I hear these constant reverberations of DHS.
Mm-hmm.
And DHS is actually the might of Damocles, if you will. You can come down on people pretty hard,
mm-hmm.
and you have all the resources available to you. And it bothers me when I hear not just one, but many cases of abuse by DHS.
Mm-hmm.
Taking a child away and giving it shots against its mother's wishes. I can't grasp that. I can't fathom the fact of where is your control?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I can understand we could do some modifications to this bill, perhaps, but it just concerns me that these things happen in this day and age, that DHS or CPS or whoever you call them has this authority to disrupt families in such a tremendous manner without any repercussions. And it doesn't seem that anybody cares other than the people that are impacted. And that bothers me severely.
Well, Chair Olson, if that's the question, and Senator Gelser, thank you for that. And I take exception with that because I bothered by it. And I think that other people are bothered by it as well. And I, when I hear about these things, it causes me a great deal of concern. I don't believe that as a government agency, it is okay. If the things that are being reported, we need to look into as they come to my attention. I look into them. If there are things that need to be addressed, I will personally address them. I know that Director Psyche has made that pretty clear as well. I work for an agency that I want to be able to defend. And it's not something that I want to sit here and say, yeah, we are doing everything. I want to be able to be in a position where I can say we are doing what we can to make sure that we are not taking advantage of our authority to our legislative mandate to investigate allegations and protect children.
Well, and I would can I just one thing. Okay, sure.
Just one thing. Then for the record, for clarification, I will ask you to provide to this committee
mm-hmm.
for the past 5 years
mm-hmm.
how many children have been taken from their parents and given vaccinations.
Vice Chair Olson, Senator Gelser, Since removal for removal of a child solely for the reasons which is being described here is that the only reason that a child was removed was because of vaccinations. Can we track that? Since it's not a reason that we can use, since it's not a data element that we removed a child because they didn't get vaccinations, because that would be an inappropriate use of a removal, it would be difficult to gather that kind of data.
Let me clarify that. I'd like to know how many people have been, how many children have been removed for whatever cause, mm-hmm. and vaccinated because DHS thought they should be vaccinated, yeah. against the parents' wishes.
So, Vice Chair Olson, Senator Gelser, again, I'm not sure that we have that particular data, because I don't know that it is captured in a way that it describes the parent was opposed to it and we did it anyway.
Let me clarify again then.
Follow up.
I would like to have information as how many children were removed from mm-hmm. their parents. Mm-hmm. for any cause whatsoever, mm-hmm. and vaccinated.
And I think that the challenge probably, sorry, go ahead.
By Chair Olson, Senator Gelser, members of the committee, I'm not sure that we have that data. I can check for you. I would be happy to do that. I suspect that because when a child is in protective custody or is in state's custody, there is a, and I'm not going to be accurate probably about the Medicaid piece or the way that this is tracked, but there's probably a mechanism that that information would be captured. I'm just not sure, and I would have to check into that, and I'm happy to do that.
Senator Gibran.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I think this is a very useful line of questioning, and it's helping to crystallize for me, I think, what perhaps needs to be considered really irrespective of what's in this bill. There may be further work to be done here, because it's, you know, if it's true that the department is not, you know, doesn't consider vaccination decisions a form of abuse or negligence, and, you know, leading to the taking of a child. But if a child is taken for whatever reason from, you know, removed from the parent's custody, and then given a vaccination, and then returned to the child, returned to the family, to the parents, mm-hmm. you know, from a certain perspective, I mean, damage has been done, right? And I'm just wondering, and this would be hard to do, would take some time, but to figure out how to craft policy that would make sure that kind of thing didn't happen, that the, sure. the parents' wishes were somehow made known and respected, certainly for a short-term removal.
Right.
So I don't know what you think about that.
Senator Dembrough and Chair Gelser, I think that I appreciate the question. This is a I think we need to have more conversations about it, and I appreciate the kind of the thoughtfulness about it. And I think the struggle at times can become, and it gets into some of the other part about kind of the medical wishes of parents. And in some cases, there are, and I don't want to equate this to a parent not getting appropriate treatment for a child, but that is part of the conversation. It is a parent not wanting to get medical treatment, which I wouldn't say that this is, that's not what I'm trying to. It kind of gets at the determination, and it's those other kinds of issues that may come up, that it's not solely about vaccinations. It's perhaps about another medical condition that a child may have, and kind of going into that area, the other condition that a child may have, and the parent not getting treatment for it. would be something that we would look at. It may be that it would go against the parents' wishes if that child was in custody for that reason. So I think that's where it becomes a really tricky kind of conversation. I think it's worth exploring. I think it's worth having the conversation about. I don't know how much more adamant I can be about, you know, vaccinations themselves being a parent choice. And I would never want anybody to, any of our screeners in our field offices, to consider that an allegation of child abuse. And we'll go back quickly and make it very clear in a statement to our field offices about this. It's where those other issues come into play. That's where it becomes more complicated.
And I wonder, with the question that Senator, and I'll come to you right in a second, Senator Knope, but with the question that Senator Dimbrough is asking, I would imagine that one of the challenges would be we have state policy and law around requirements for vaccinations, a public health issue when kids are in a congregate care setting, in a foster home is a congregate care setting where you have multiple children, you're not necessarily able to manage which children are there. So contact. That might be an issue to where, yes. I know, for instance, if you're a foster parent, you can't just go and get your foster kid a haircut. You're right. Consulting with the family around the haircut issues. Yeah. I'm not sure what flexibility the department really has given the other regulations around licensing and vaccination when kids are in a child care facility, and that might be an information hearing later.
And I think, Madam Chair, I think that it would be nice to know what the rules are, what rules DHS has. Once they become ward of the care. State is different than one that's temporarily in the custody, and there should be a difference, I would think.
And I think clearly two different issues have been raised here. One is the issue of whether vaccination
is child abuse.
Is child abuse. And the second is what happens regarding vaccination when a child is in care. So the story we heard today, and I saw you working with my staff, and I know you to be very responsive when in looking into these kinds of issues. I heard that issue not as one of removal because of vaccination, but the question of whether wishes around vaccination were followed following the removal. And those are two very distinct issues. Senator Knope.
Yes, and my question really was along that line, and maybe it's already been asked, but do you, does CPS or DHS have a policy about vaccinating kids once they've taken them into custody? Is there a policy, a procedure?
Senator Knope, Chair Elser, members of the committee, I don't know. I can find that out pretty quickly. It is because it's not an area of administrative rule that I am like really up to speed on. So I can check that, and we can have an answer back shortly to the committee.
Okay, thank you.
And then I just a final word. I think if you think about the conversations we've had in the building about child welfare over the last few weeks and the pendulum, it really points to how difficult the work is. So last week we're having a hearing in which the department is criticized for not moving quickly enough to address safety concerns for kids. Today we're having a conversation about, does the department move too rapidly to take action when they feel that kids aren't safe? And I don't think we can emphasize enough how difficult that work is, how much it depends on the workers that are doing the work, and therefore how much that goes back to an adequately trained and supported and staffed workforce, which really underlies all of these things. If you've got workers that know what the law is, and here you have the director of Child Protective Services saying, no, that is not a reason for removal is not a parent's decision
to vaccinate.
But how you get that message out to everyone in the state, regardless of what the law says, because we have a number of these conversations again around decisions that get made and are they consistent with the law or the rule. So I would just, again, whether it's the issues we heard last week or these issues, we've got to get to a place where we have enough workers to do the work and that we're giving them the training they need before we send them out into the field to make these decisions that very significantly impact mothers and fathers and, most importantly, children. So thank you for coming to work every day, even though you have to work really hard. No matter what you do, we tell you it's wrong. That kind of has to be very frustrating.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And with that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 687. And we're adjourned. And with that, I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 687.